Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, back from my holidays in Brazil. Oh, when my baby smiles at me, I go to Rio. Yeah, I'm raring to get back into the wonderful world of cinema, thank you very much. My great thanks to Zan Brooks and Paul McInnes for standing in for me so ably while I was away, and to the many contributors from throughout The Guardian and The Observer who appeared on those shows. We do love our film here. This week, I'm joined by illustrious guests to remember the huge, beaming contribution to film made by the late Anthony Minghella, who so sadly died earlier this week. Joe Wright joins me from the scene of a moving tribute in Los Angeles, and jazz trumpeter Guy Barker shares his memories of working with Anthony on The Talented Mr. Ripley and on the number one ladies' detective agency, which will be broadcast this Sunday night on BBC One. I also look at a brave new era for London's art house cinemas as the legendary Everyman Cinema from Hampstead spreads its wings, and we've got reviews of the latest releases and go to New York for the inaugural Cinema Eye Documentary Awards. That's all to come on Film Weekly. We start, of course, with the sad news of the sudden death of director Anthony Minghella, who passed away this week at the age of 54. The Oscar-winning director and screenwriter of The English Patient suffered a fatal hemorrhage at Charing Cross Hospital in London, where he'd undergone an operation last week on a growth in his neck. Minghella had most recently completed the BBC film The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, based on Alexander McCall Smith's novel set in Botswana, and it's due to premiere, as I said earlier, this Sunday, March the 23rd, on BBC One. He co-wrote the adaptation with Richard Curtis. His last cinema movie was, of course, Breaking and Entering in 2006, a much underrated film which I thought rather interesting. His other movie credits include Cold Mountain, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Mr. Wonderful, and Truly Madly Deeply. He had, of course, recently stepped down as chairman of the British Film Institute after serving 4 years in the role. Minghella won Best Director for The English Patient at the Oscars in 1997 and got another nomination in 2000 for the screenplay of Talented Mr. Ripley. He also directed an opera, Puccini's Madame Butterfly, at London's English National Opera in 2005 and later took the production to New York's Met. I was personally proud to have known him well. He was a visible presence at every London Film Festival, and I fondly recall spending several days with him in Shanghai 2 years ago as part of a delegation from Film London. We parted and dined and lectured film students at the university, lectures that always turned into lively, giggling debates, during which he learned as much about Chinese cinema from the young, keen students as they did from him. He was one of the gentlest, most gracious men you could ever meet, witty and always interested, probing, and I found him ever keen to both impart and absorb knowledge about film, football, music and food. He made his only acting appearance as a TV interviewer in the final section of Joe Wright's Atonement, so I called Joe in Los Angeles to find out how he remembered Anthony.
You know, Anthony was like a bit of a godfather to a whole generation of filmmakers. During the development of the screenplay of Atonement, he read the screenplay, and then I spent a number of sessions with him, usually evenings, at his office. He'd just ask me really annoying questions, basically. He needled me about my reasons for each choice I was making, and it was a bit of a masterclass in storytelling. He asked all the most difficult questions and all the bits that I thought, oh, I'll just get away with that, or thought I could get away with, he'd pull me up on. And it made me just very carefully consider everything that I was doing. This is the man's generosity of spirit, really. He was an incredibly generous filmmaker, and really it was an education. It was a masterclass for me.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at him as you know, people in the film industry, yourselves and myself, tangentially, that he's not like a godfather figure, but he was very much a kind of sort of friend of the current generation. He's kind of the older statesman of the current generation, you know what I mean? He had this kind
Absolutely.
Of everyone feels like a tremendous affection for him as a friend. I think I don't look at him as a father, but I really feel I've lost a kind of friend who knew what they were doing in this difficult world.
Yeah, absolutely. And the industry is a more frightening place without him, you know. Him having been involved in the development of the project in that way I was then desperately trying to think of who I could cast as the interviewer, and we thought about real journalists, and we thought about kind of Melvin Bragg or people like that. But what I didn't want was a day player. I wanted someone who, you know, I knew that the focus had to be totally on Vanessa that day. It had to be, we had to make sure that she felt comfortable and that no one was going to steal the attention from her or take up any emotional space with their nerves or angst. And I think it was actually Rosamund who came up with the idea of casting Anthony. And he did just that. He came along and he allowed Vanessa the space to be able to do what she did. Her performance is also a testament to his generosity. Seamus McGarvey, who was the DOP on Number One Ladies Protective Agency, had received a call early in the morning. And obviously we were all devastated, dedicated the day's filming to him. We were filming with the LA Philharmonic Orchestra. And so it was a fitting scene. They were playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the third movement. And I made a little announcement and we dedicated the day's filming to him.
Joe Wright from the set of The Soloist in Los Angeles, scene of what sounds like an extremely moving tribute to Anthony Minghella. Trumpeter Guy Barker became a friend of Minghella's when they collaborated on the wonderful soundtrack to The Talented Mr. Ripley. I called Guy to ask how he'd reacted to the news.
It was just disbelief. When I got the call yesterday, I was driving on the way to Plymouth. I was in the back of a car on the way down there. And we just pulled in at a service station, and I found myself just stood in the entrance with my mouth open, just looking around. It was just dazed for ages.
Yeah, and a trumpeter with his mouth open is no good at all.
No. I mean, I was supposed to see him on Friday, because there was a screening for Number One Ladies Detective Agency, which I did some work on, and I just heard he wasn't well.
Mm.
And that's it, you know, and I've spoken to him quite a lot and seen a bit of him during this last film. It's always a joy to work with him, and then suddenly this, it still doesn't make sense. I mean, everybody's upside down, you know, they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that's quite right. Guy, just tell us a little bit about your collaborations with Anthony. I mean, I suppose the most famous and the one that kind of really boosted you in terms of your involvement in the movies was The Talented Mr. Ripley and that wonderful soundtrack that you created with him, and you were even in that movie as well.
What I did was I arranged about six jazz standards for the film, and they were looking for somebody to lead the jazz group and to arrange all the jazz and be a sort of a jazz advisor on the film, if you like. And Anthony heard the first track, which was The Peacocks, and he heard it and apparently said, "Get me this bloke." So I was invited over to Rome and sat with Anthony for a weekend in this beautiful apartment, listening to lots of music, and he would just ask me, well, he wanted to know what the people would be playing at that time. And he was his attention to detail, as you know, was always incredible. Nothing, you know, no stone was unturned.
So he was interested in, you know, exactly the type of early bebop that would have been played on
the coast.
Well,
it was exactly that thing. And what happened was, if you notice during the film, there's a recurring theme that goes through it, which is the old standard, You Don't Know What Love Is, which is on my album, What Love Is, and Sting sings it. And we do a version of it with John Martin on the closing credits. And you occasionally you hear, in St. Mark's Square, there's a point where you hear a saxophone player playing it, and then you hear Jude Law playing it at one point. What happened was he wanted The Peacocks to go through it, but he found out that the film was set in 1958 and Peacocks was written in 1960. And so because of that, he said, we can't do that then. And so he went to the second track and said, well, we'll use this.
That's exactly what a filmmaker should do, because people would pick up on it. It would be wrong, even if it was the one that you liked the most. It would be wrong, and I'm glad you insisted on, you know, the 2 years.
Was Anthony's decision. Mm. It's the sort of thing where I thought, oh, it's only 2 years. Could we get away with it? But Anthony, absolutely no.
No, because even the clothes were correct in Ripley. You know, exactly the right threads for the right movie.
Absolutely, everything was, you know, the attention to detail. Like I say, it was amazing. I mean, to the point where We pre-recorded, obviously, as you always do, all the music, and then, you know, we mimed to it, because obviously there's so many different angles you're shooting from, and you're going to be playing the same thing for 2 days, you know, to get a scene right. And there was one particular moment when we were in the jazz club, I always remember, and he'd had all the solos, the improvised solos that we played, he'd had them transcribed and the music sent to us, so we had to learn our own solos off by heart, so we would look completely convincing when we were miming to them, which is something I'd never come across before. So, you know, people would, you know, just let that go.
Mm.
But, you know, he insisted everything, right down to the bass player. So he was playing exactly the same notes, even if he, you know, so if he wandered a bit, no, you have to stick with everything you played on the record. And there was one point where the cinematographer had got a shot from the side of the stage. He just said, look, I've got a great shot here. I can see through the hi-hat of the drums, I can see over the cymbals, and I can see Matt Damon's face at the top of the piano. It's a really great shot. And so Anthony said, great, we'll shoot it from there. And then he just said to the bass player, he said, look, the only thing that's in the way is your hand on the neck of the bass. If you could just move your hand up 5 inches, that would be perfect. So the bass player said, yeah, sure. And immediately Anthony jumped on the stage, looked at the bass player, said, would you do that? So he said, what do you mean? He said, could you play the notes you're supposed to be playing with your hand up there? And he said, no. So he said, we can't do it. Find another way of shooting it. And, you know, there might be two bass players who might notice, but he did it in a way that he wanted to make a gift, if you like, to musicians, so that there wouldn't be a musician in the audience going, oh, you know, they've done it wrong again, like
yeah.
they do in every other movie. But he loved all music.
Obviously, there seems to be a connection between the two of you that wasn't, you know, just that started on Mr. Ripley, but carried on as well.
I mean, the whole experience of working on Ripley was fantastic. And like I said, Andy was so, you know, I think happy with the music. And I got to invite an awful lot of other friends. There would be calls, even when I wasn't needed, I'd get calls from the office saying, look, we've got a bit where we need a soprano sax and all these things. And this would go on. And then once we'd done it all and we'd finished the recording, Anthony said, look, would you play at the premieres? So at about 7 or 8 of the premieres, my quintet, we played for a set, you know, after the film at the party. And so it was great. We played in, you know, Hollywood and New York, Chicago, Berlin, Paris. And that was great. And then Anthony and I stayed in touch. And then just more recently, I got a call to ask whether I would work with him on Number One Ladies Detective Agency. There's a scene in there. There's a sort of very comical seduction scene. He asked if I would rearrange a traditional African song and sort of create it in a style that would sort of sound like my quintet, but very much in the sort of 50s Miles Davis sound. And again, you know, it was just fantastic because I felt like I'd been sort of reunited with him again, and we worked again on that, and it was great. And then the screening was last Friday.
Yeah, and it goes out on BBC One on Sunday night. And I mean, obviously, we'll all be watching and listening for our. We just spoke to Joe Wright in LA, who's a cinematographer. Seamus McGarvey was working on that film, and your music will be in that film. It's amazing the sort of areas that Anthony McGinnis seems to have reached just by gentle support. You know, from music to critics to journalists to people who want to study film. Basically, all over the arts in the UK, it seems that he's touched it. He's touched many areas.
Oh, he has. And he's the kindest, most generous man you could have ever met. I mean, when he walked into the room, you know, people say you felt a presence. And the reason was because he just seemed to just glow with generosity. And he made everybody feel important.
Jazz musician Guy Barker there, ending Film Weekly's tribute to the lovely man who was Anthony Minghella. Minghella was also a great friend of his local cinema in Hampstead, the Everyman. He hosted many events in the famous old rep house and often could be spotted catching up with films as a member of the audience. The Everyman is also where I received my early education in French New Wave and US Indies, in foreign language films and cult classics. The small Hampstead cinema expanded this week when it bought the other legendary London chain of Screen Cinemas, Screen on the Green, Screen on the Hill and the Screen on Baker Street, three other venues where I've spent many happy hours in the dark. I caught up with Everyman Group founder Daniel Brock to discover that this heralds a brand new era for London rep cinema, and a much comfier one too. Well, I've just entered into a hive of cinematic activity. The most buzzy story in London at the moment is that institutions of London cinema, the Screen on the Hill, the Screen on the Green, and the Screen on Baker Street, have been taken over by the Everyman Media Group. I'm sitting with the smiling CEO and founder of the Everyman Media Group. We came from that bastion of art house cinema up in Hampstead Village, the Everyman Cinema, where I grew up and cut my cinema teeth. Daniel Brock, welcome to Film Weekly. Congratulations on your new possessions.
Welcome, and gratefully accepted.
It's very important for me to come and talk to you about this because, as I said, I grew up watching films at the Everyman, films that started with Jim Jarmusch and went back to Fellini, and then also kind of carried on that at the Screen on the Hill and the Screen on the Green. Those are the three cinemas where I kind of really grew up as a film goer and a film critic. And I think a lot of Londoners will feel exactly the same way. So this is a very significant shift in the landscape of London cinema, but almost a kind of seamless passing of the baton as well, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time coming. We started our journey about 6 years ago up in Hampstead with Everyman, where we sort of have been on this process already because we took over a failing cinema, which had been bankrupt twice, and came in with some fresh eyes and some fresh ideas. And I think, on the whole, we've improved and enhanced, you know, significantly. And, you know, we want to take the same approach to the Screen sites now. We want to be respectful and sensitive and all that type of thing, but we want to, you know, we want to put our efforts into improving and enhancing and building on where they are in the market and have been for the last 30 years.
Now, they've obviously done quite well as sites, these films. They've been very well programmed. They have a certain sort of film at these sites, a sort of, not highbrow, but art house circuit, one would call them. It was a friend to the foreign films. It was a friend to the kind of more indie film cinemas when that revolution was going on in the 90s. Is that the same sort of ethos you'll be keeping, or how will you be kind of changing the cinema going experience for Londoners?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's looking at what the historical trend is in terms of where they've come from and how we can best evolve that going forward. I think the landscape is, you know, it's different, very different these days. You know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago, different ball game. And I think we've got to move with the times. I think for us, it's all about how we can make it an interesting experience for the customer. And the funny thing is the more we improve that, the more successful we are with that, strangely enough, the more options we have in terms of content. It's a weird dynamic there, right? You think that, you know, the more narrow we are with that, the less options we have with content, because we can't deliver the results to make people notice us. And the minute people notice us, more people want to give us content. So in fact, it works the other way around. You see what I'm saying?
So let's make this a little more concrete example. I recently went up to the Everyman to see your spanking brand new print of La Dolce Vita up there, and there was a bit of music on beforehand, a bit of live music. But there were canapes being handed around. I could drink. It was much more fun than going to see it at the View Multiplex, for example. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about? The cinema experience? Is that what's sort of going to get me off my sofa and watching my DVDs at home?
Absolutely. It's all about value-added experiences for the customer they respond to. We've got a central and a thriving events department where we're looking at ways to marry up films with events, exactly as you just described, and then place them into our venues. And then as they get audience, so therefore we get a voice, then more content providers come on board and go, "Hold on a minute, that's not a bad idea. Listen, we might re-release that, or we might do this." And what that does is it starts to get you a little bit more flexible than the fixed 2-week release process that everyone is locked into. So as we go down that path, I think the content will become more varied and more interesting. We just got to get on the path.
Yeah, because it is that tried and tested formula that still obtains around the country, around in London, that a film plays for a bit. If it's successful in its opening weekend, it goes on for another run. If not, it gets whipped off. And I don't think that model is particularly helping London film going, London filmmakers either as well. There's a lot of opportunities being missed, I think, by exhibitors.
But you see, think of it like this. If you were in the business of programming cinema screens, you know, let's just imagine cinema screens on their own along a back wall, there's 10 of them. If that's your business, right, then basically you want to make that as fluid as possible. They come in one end, go out the other end, okay? If your business is what you can do around that content to enhance it and to make it more interesting, okay, then you don't have to get so locked into that process. You can be a bit more flexible. And I think there's always been a tradition of that type of thing in screen anyway, actually. I think, I don't know if you know, but the Sex Pistols played live at the Screen on the Green. Do you know that?
I wasn't there.
don't know what you're saying. No, hold on, look.
I wasn't suggesting you were, but either was I. But I didn't even know. You know, so there's. So when you start going into the history of these things, I think that we're going to pick up a few little nuggets, which will say, hold on a minute, we'll look at that and try and bring that forward. Look, we need to make some significant investment in the sites, in the technology. And this, you know, there's some givens in the 21st century you need to have, right? You need to have internet reservations. You need to have a telephone system that works. You know, all these things that which they don't have. So as we build that platform, then I think we will get this sort of dynamic through the whole thing, which will all be an extension of what we do in Hampstead, which you've already said, you know, works very well.
I mean, is this the kind of almost a return of rep cinema? I've talked about it many times, the death of rep cinema that used to have flea pits like the Scala that would show all-night films. They would show, lost films. They would show kind of edgy films, films that couldn't get certificates elsewhere. Are you looking at that now that you've got three or four sites to play with? You can have a varied programme up your sleeve.
Well, again, it comes back to my point. I think with more scale and more voice, you get more options. And if you have a cultural mindset, which is about what are you doing that's customer-centric, then I think in a way you are going back to what you just said, but obviously with a modern take. If you don't have that mindset, and I come back to my point I just made, and then you are just programming cinema screens, and just it's then just week in, week out, get them on, get them out, okay? Listen, let's be honest, it's a viable business model when you've got 4 billion seats or whatever it is, you know? But with us, we don't have that scale. What we've got is great locations, great access to audience, great history. There's an age demographic split, I would say, in terms of where our primary relationship is with our customer. Mm. And our primary relationship is with a customer between 25 and 45, I'd say. It's the over 25s. Now, that's not to say it excludes children, because they bring their families with them, strange, but because the dialogue is the other way around, OK? If you're in multiplex cinema, your dialogue's with the teenager who drags the dad along, doesn't particularly want to go. With us, the dialogue's the other way around. So we get the adult, and primarily we probably get the woman of the couple. So she drags the whole family in that way around. So our dynamic, our language is based on that type of demographic split.
Obviously, I think this is very good news for London cinema, but it's not just London cinema as well. When you get the screen chain, it's not just on the hill and in Hampstead. It's where is it? Where, Reigate, Winchester,
Walton on Thames, Winchester, Reigate, Oxford, and Winchester. And we've got Hammersmith opening in 2010, which is a new landmark development, a new landmark site there. We're just about to sign up in Leeds, and we've got various other pipeline sites coming through as well. But you see, the thing is, you know, when I first got involved in this business, and I don't come from a film background, you know, maybe that's been my advantage in this whole thing, you know, that I just looked at it and thought, hold on, as a customer, what do I want to respond to? You know, I'm probably terribly simple about this. You know, I think that in the main, if you're a working family, you know, you're a working couple of children, I think that, you know, 10 days in the house, and you've got to get out. That's the bottom line, okay? You know what I mean? You can't stay. And the thing is, where do you go? You know, people just want to, it's that sort of release. And I think if they can do that in a way that enriches them in some way, it's a win-win all round.
Daniel Brock of the Everyman Group there. It's interesting news, this. I mean, we hear so much from producers and directors about getting films together and made, but we often forget that on this side of the business, how important it is that we actually get out and see things and how difficult that can be sometimes. Let's have a look what's available on Seats for Your Bums this week. The Spiderwick Chronicles is the latest film to jump on the Harry Potter broomstick with a contribution in the family fantasy film genre. It's not bad, indeed, quite fun in places, as prolific British kid Freddie Highmore plays twins taken from New York to live in a big, creepy country house by his mum, played by Mary Louise Parker. How nice it is to see this actress again, and this must be one of the best mum-to-son match-ups in screen history. They even have the same nose. Anyway, at the house, the twins discover a dusty book left by an eccentric great-uncle, played rather half-heartedly by David Strathairn. See, this is the sort of thing that happens to you when you get an Oscar nomination. The book lets them see into the fantastical world of brownies, goblins, sylphs, ogres and Nick Nolte's. Only Joan Plowright can save them. The movie gets very noisy and loses its sense of fun halfway through, but it should entertain young ones enough. A big creepy house movie for adults is The Orphanage, a much-praised Spanish chiller in which the excellent Belén Rueda returns to her big gothic childhood orphanage in rainy northern Spain. It's picturesque Asturias, for those of you with a Ryanair timetable. Now married to a successful doctor, she's turning the orphanage into a home for special needs children. But her own son, Simon, starts seeing imaginary friends, starts shouting a lot, and then disappears.
Rueda sets about proving he's been taken by the spirits and eventually gets Geraldine Chaplin's psychic in, who tells her, "Seeing is not believing. Believe and you will see." That sounds good, but actually it doesn't mean much, rather like the film as a whole, I'm afraid. Mixing various classic shock tactics with a bit of Peter Pan, the film, presented by Pan's Labyrinth director Guillermo del Toro, but directed by first-timer J.A. Bayona, it has plenty of atmosphere, but not enough logic and shading to guide us through the confusion on screen. Just as films such as The Ring and Dark Water have become known as J-horror for Japan whence they come, it looks like we're going to have to coin the term S-horror for the crop of somewhat pompous fairy tales now emanating from the Spanish-speaking world. Step Up to the Street is a total contrast and a guilty pleasure for me, I'm afraid. A tearaway girl from Gorilla Street Dancing Outfit 410 is allowed into the prestigious Maryland School of Arts. She pouts, she sweats, she spins and urges her fellow pupils to ditch the fundraiser and join the battle against the street crews. If her mum will let her, of course. Hooray! There's plenty of formation dancing too in the unbelievably rubbish Meet the Spartans, a crushingly unfunny yet unsurprisingly box office topping spoof of last year's blockbuster 300, as leather-clad warriors skip off to war singing I Will Survive. Oh yeah. They're led, incredibly, by Sean Maguire, who used to be in EastEnders. What with Michelle Ryan as the Barnick woman, soon it'll be Letitia Dean in the Marilyn Monroe story and Phil Mitchell as Arthur Miller. Sorry, Arthur Miller. There is a drama documentary out this week called Sous les Bombes, Under the Bombs, in which a wealthy Arab woman hires a taxi driver to take her into the war zone of South Lebanon to seek her lost son during the fragile ceasefire of Israeli bombardment in 2005. This is a blindly biased film that thinks it's provocative and heartfelt, but which, on every level, even as an angry piece of anti-Israel propaganda, desperately fails to find any authenticity or credibility. Better docs were, I'm sure, on display at the first ever Doc Oscars, or the Cinema Eye Awards, in New York earlier this week. The Guardian sent Nell Bowes out there to have a look, and she joins me on the line from the Big Apple now. Nell, how was it exciting mixing with all those filmmakers?
Oh, it was fantastic. There was a great buzz. They're a good clique, the documentary makers. They've all been on the circuit for all year, and they were all pretty thrilled to meet up.
You know, we see documentaries get their own category at the Oscars. We see them get the category at the BAFTAs. They're always kind of like an afterthought amongst the main film awards. So I suppose they wanted to get together and create their own Oscars, really.
Well, that's kind of the thing. There's the idea that documentaries don't really get credited for cinematography and for editing and for the kind of craft behind it, because I think there's maybe a slight feeling that they're strictly, you know, reportage, journalistic, talking heads genre. And yet, I mean, you're looking at some of the films that have come out this year, Amanda Bala and Into Great Silence about the Carthusian monks. And they're just, you know, they're stunning. They're works of art.
There are an amazing amount of stories that get covered in documentaries, aren't there, Neil?
Well, it's astonishing. And it's the variety of kind of scope as well. It's the tiny, there's a narrow focus on Billy the Kid, which is the film that won the debut feature. It's actually, you know, just a couple of days in the life of a 15-year-old in Maine. And then you compare that with Amanda Bala, that spreads from hostage takers in Sao Paulo to rich and rather corrupt officials in the Amazon basin. And I mean, just the range of scope is fantastic.
And there's also, I mean, there's also a great amount of craft that goes into documentary making. It isn't just one man or one woman and her camera. There's editing as well. I noticed that the Amanda Bala, which won in the editing category as well, but it was up against a film like Crazy Love, which kind of assembles archive footage, clippings and talking heads and puts them all together to make a flow. I think making a documentary, people forget what it is to chisel all this kind of fiction or at least this kind of story out of the kind of bare facts that you've got.
They were saying, you know, as they presented the editing award, that it's, you know, it can be a painful process as a documentary, because you've got all this fascinating footage from different areas, and yet there's a limit to kind of how much you can control what you've got. It's sort of objet trouvé, and it's God, I sound terribly pretentious now, but it's a fascinating process and they're all hugely committed to it.
Now, I really don't mind sounding pretentious. You're on Film Weekly, it's The Guardian. If you can't be pretentious here now, where can you be pretentious?
Especially surrounded by non-fiction filmmakers.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the first awards. It's sponsored by online film distributor IndiePix, of course. They're called the Cinema Eye Awards. It's the first year. What sort of award have they come up with? What does it look like, an eye?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's this guy from Woodstock who has concocted this large... It weighs about 12 pounds. I mean, you know, it's significantly more than an Oscar. It's this large bronze eye with big eyelashes and a lens for the centre of it. So they're quite striking, but they're very good. It was nice to see people waving them around.
Nell Bowes in New York, and you can join her and the online film community on our blogs this week about the state of independent non-fiction filmmaking all week on guardian.co.uk. That's about it from me, Jason Solomons, for this edition. Have a great Easter break and weekend. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble, and of course, this week's show is dedicated to the memory of Anthony Minghella. Until next week, happy viewing.